Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, our speaker today is Mary Kramer, and she's a familiar face, I think, to many of you. Even some people who go to Paula's down in Valley Junction. I heard that about you, Mary. And I had a chance to meet her a few months ago at lunch. And she was just delightful. I really enjoyed my time with her. She's just a really, really fun, very interesting woman. So I think you're going to just really enjoy her talk today. There's lots of information about her on the back of the brochure, so I'll let you read through that because she's just done so many, many things. So, Mary, if you'd like to step up, and also, she's going to take some questions, so be ready to ask something fun or serious.
Okay. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Can you hear? Nope. Yes? Okay. I have a school teacher voice, and so I can make myself heard, but that's much nicer. It's much nicer to have a microphone. Me to speak today, I am pretty passionate about the whole idea of international service and what we as Americans might want to take from it. So I'm looking forward to visiting with you today. And as you read all this stuff about me on the back, thank you for not reading all that again. I used to, when someone asked me about how to be introduced, I said, well, my favorite introduction is that she's a graduate of Miss Heppel-White School for Recalcitrant Girls. That would be me. And as you looked at that, you probably understand why my dear dad was worried that I couldn't hold a job. Copies of both my books, which I would be glad to sign for you, but I'm terribly gratified by the number of you who have said, I enjoyed your book already. So, and I would tell you that it's my friends at Styx and my friend Alice at Beaverdale Book have my books as well as Amazon, which if you like e-readers like I do, go that way. Okay, now, my goals for the day are first, I hope you laugh and learn. And I will think I've been successful. Well, you've already laughed a couple of times, so that's a good thing. I would remind you there are no dumb questions.
But she's off again.
Uh-huh. I'm on. Okay, here we go. And so my idea today is that I will talk a little bit about the role of the ambassador. I'll talk a little bit about the work of U.S. embassies. I think we are not as well versed about that as we might be. And then, you know, the standing ovation is always good. I have to say I've had an incredible life's experience. Who would think a girl who's grown up in Iowa would be able to do all the things that I have had opportunity and taken the risk to try? It's really, really gratifying. I wouldn't have missed those years we served in Barbados for anything. But I say we have a whole new appreciation of home, weather notwithstanding. I did learn that the weather is not paramount to our happiness. In fact, it's the friends and the family and the people that surround us are what make the difference. My call to service came at the end of one of the legislative sessions when I had already decided I wasn't going to run again because I realized I wasn't suffering fools as gladly as I once did. I'm completely out of patience at the time. So we, after that session, we went off to Hilton Head for a vacation. And when we got off the plane, my phone was blinking away. And I said, it's 6 o'clock on Friday night. I am not returning calls. But then we got to the resort, and the girl behind the desk said to me, Senator Kramer, you need to call your office immediately. So you think, oh gosh, somebody died or something. So I called, and she said, call the White House. I said, no. It's 6 o'clock on Friday, Eastern time. There won't be anybody there. Yes, they're waiting for you. Call them. So I call. And she said, this is White House personnel. That was new. The president, she got right to it. We didn't waste any time. She said, the president would like to know if you'd be interested in serving as the ambassador to Barbados. And he'd like to have you call back on Monday at 3 o'clock and tell us your answer. The end. So I sat down. My husband said, what's wrong with you? Are you okay? I said, so I told him, and then he sat down. But you know what? Neither one of us even knew where Barbados was. You know, we didn't. So, as you often do, we went to Barnes & Noble and got a book and a cup of coffee and figured out what's there. And after a few minutes of reading, we looked at each other and said, well, how bad can that be? Maybe we ought to investigate this. And so I called, but, you know, I had no clue what an ambassador did. And I'm just learning where Barbados was. I clearly knew no one had never been there. And so I said, I'm terribly, terribly flattered, sir, but I don't know if I'm qualified or if I want to uproot everything and live abroad for 4 years. So she said, could you hold a minute? And I said, yes. And so pretty soon, Mary, I hear you have a question. It's the President of the United States. So I babbled something about cutting ribbons and leaving home and I don't know what all. And pretty soon he said, I'm not sending you there for a walk on the beach. Well, one of my ambassador colleagues wrote a book that said, when the president calls, the answer is always yes. Actually, yes, sir. Okay, so it began an 8-month-long vetting process. And we couldn't tell anybody until the White House made the formal announcement. And so people were getting questioned by the FBI and the security people from the State Department about us, and they didn't know why. And so they kept calling us saying, are you okay? Many people thought the IRS was after us. So anyway, finally got announced and it's all good. But this vetting process left us with no secrets. Everything about our health, everything about our finances, every place we'd ever lived, every place we'd ever worked, every place we'd gone to school, and somebody who would know us from that time, named. And then 25 people that didn't appear anyplace else. Well, folks, by this time, you know, it was getting down to the Christmas card list. But we passed. We passed. And we went to a thing they call the Ambassadorial Seminar, which is 2-3 weeks long in Washington, and my husband was expected to attend with me. He's very proud he passed, because they call it charm school. And anyway, he has a certificate that proves he passed, so that's good. But a wonderful experience was the swearing-in ceremony in the State Department, and then Secretary of State Colin Powell swore us in. And he said to me, Mary, do you understand the mission? I said, yes, sir. And will you support your troops? Went, yes, sir. Then he said, you're on my team, sister. Isn't that great? And so now he takes me by the shoulders. He's going to give me the kiss. And so I'm thinking, okay, we know. Well, as it turns out, you know, the diplomatic kiss is on each cheek. I didn't know that. So we wound up rubbing noses in front of 300 people. And he said, wait, you need to know about this. So he takes me by the shoulders and we do it right, everyone applauds. Okay, and then we're off. So, to a country we'd never been, to live in a house we'd never seen, to work with people we'd never met, an unbelievable opportunity for two Iowans. Leaving Iowa, it was -4, a little blowing snow. We arrived in Barbados, 85, and sunny. It's pretty good so far. And we learned the privileges. On the plane, you know, we now have a diplomatic passport. It's magic. Everybody just kind of salutes and sends you on through and then takes your luggage, and it's great. And then we had a beautiful residence, so we flip through that, and our driver picks us up and drives us to the residence, and it's high up on a coral hill, and it looks over the Caribbean, and so we see the sunset every day. Every day at 6, actually. It's so close to the equator that we don't have any nice long evenings. It comes up at 6 and it goes down at 6 all year, every day. So 85 by day, 75 by night, every day of the year. The only surprise is when it's going to rain and for how long. So there's two seasons, the rainy season and the dry season. We had a hard time telling them apart. Because it rained pretty much every day, you know, in the afternoon. It was okay. It wasn't a problem, but it was, it's not a problem, because I had a driver who dropped me off at the door every place I went, and I didn't have to find a parking place or anything. It was cool. In another life, I might like to have a driver. My husband thinks he is the driver. So, about October now, the house manager says to us, "What do you like to celebrate for Thanksgiving? Because we would like to honor your traditions." It can't be Thanksgiving. The leaves haven't changed. We haven't been to football. School didn't start. No. It was. Anyway. And so they became our family, this staff. Rita, our house manager. Norma, our housekeeper. Ricardo, the butler, Glenn, the chef, and David, the gardener, Peter, and the driver and bodyguard, who drove me everywhere in a fully armored SUV. But I don't know why if you're supposed to be in secret, you should not put the flags on the front fenders. But there they are, the American flag here and the State Department flag there. Kay would tell you that he drove a very small Toyota, and on the wrong side of the road. But his trips were to the airport, to the Rotary meetings, and to the golf course. But the airport was a long ways. The island is 21 by 24, and we were kind of crossways the long way to get to the airport. But we were so glad to have company, and shame on you of those who didn't make it. Because we had this great residence. It had 5 bedrooms, every bedroom had a bath, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't doing the shopping, I wasn't washing the sheets. So, y'all come. It was just great. Things we will always remember include the amount of security we lived with. Our bedroom was a safe haven with bars on the doors and on the windows. Had 5 telephones. One of them red, and a 2-way radio. One to the guardhouse on the grounds, and one to the Marines. Every Friday morning at 6 a.m., there was a radio check from the Marines. My handle was Hawkeye. Does that make sense? Yes. So the radio would come on and say, "Hawkeye, do you read me?" And if I didn't answer immediately, within 3 minutes, there's security at my bedroom door. So I learned that lesson the very first Friday that this happened. So the garden and the yard was fenced, and the security at the gate was 24/7, and they walked the yard every 2 hours. Was I ever threatened or scared? No, I really wasn't, but our training made it clear that high-profile Americans are targets, I think, maybe more so now even than when we were there. So we told each other, let's not be stupid. We're going to do the what we're told. We did now and then sneak out on a Saturday night down the hill for dinner. If we didn't have an engagement, and so Kay would drive and we'd go down the hill to a restaurant. And of course we had to check in and out of our gate like it's your parents, you know. Where are you going? How long will you be gone? Who's going to be there? Even when he just went to play golf, that's he was doing this. So most every time we would look over in the bar and there would be one of the security officers kind of, you only thought you got away. So, but it's amazing how that changes your perspective. To this day, I appreciate being able to go into my garage, get into my car, and drive myself wherever I want to go. I never drove once while I was in Barbados, not once. So, it reminds us again how blessed we are to live in Iowa. Kay is an ambassador, and he served at two. His activities with Rotary, golfing, and members of the business community probably did a better job of integrating us into the society than my exchange, which is with other members of the diplomatic corps and elected officials. Did I mention we had seven countries? My title was United States Ambassador Extraordinary and Plenipotentiary. Try putting that on a form. To the seven islands nations of the Eastern Caribbean, Barbados, Grenada, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, St. Lucia, St. Kitts and Nevis, Dominica, Antigua and Barbuda. Those were our nations. And many of you have been there. And you see sun, sea, and sand. They appear to be remarkably similar. I would tell you they're not, because the interchange between them is so seldom. You just can't get in your car and drive to Antigua. The kids don't play ball against each other. The artists don't share their work. It is, each island is a little kingdom unto itself. And that makes it a little bit hard to get them to collaborate on things they should collaborate. Of those, Barbados was the largest with 250,000 people. St. Kitts and Nevis the smallest with 40,000 people. But since their independence, the British, my English ladies with their hats back there, at some point decided they could no longer afford to be the Commonwealth. So to their credit, they spun off all these small nations into democracies. But Barbados was the oldest, and this year was its 50th year of independence. The independence is so fresh and so vibrant. It is a wonderful thing. Antigua had elections shortly after we got there. 93% of Antiguans voted. Yeah. They celebrate Independence Days. And no matter the size, their leaders now are all players on the world stage. Even though many of them lead fewer people than the mayors of our area, they have a vote in the United Nations General Assembly, and it's one of their most valuable tools. I'm going to give you a brief word about the United Nations. Early on, about 50 nations came together, all with common interests: the mission, peacekeeping, and humanitarian assistance. Over time, there are lots of emerging democracies, which has now qualified their membership in the General Assembly. Partly thanks to the UK dissolving the Commonwealth, but also Latin and South America, Eastern Europe, Africa, Asia. If you think of the things that have been happening over 40 years, you realize they're all of a sudden 270 independent nations represented in the United Nations General Assembly. That's the good news. The not so good news is most of the newer members are primarily interested in winning as much as they can. That is, their self-interest in their own economic development. Now, I find that forgivable because they are so desperate. St. Kitts and Nevis at 40,000 people, how are they going to support a democracy? How are they going to support public school, law enforcement, courts, public health? Usually that just means clean water. It's roads. I mean, they are just 40,000 people, and their revenue is primarily from two things. The first is tourism. And if you have been on cruises and you get off, mostly it's have a lunch and buy a t-shirt and get back on. Sometimes you do a tour, but that's pretty much it. So that's the number one source of revenue. The number two is remittances from their families that work somewhere else, either in the Caribbean, either they work in the UK, Canada, or America. So, and I'm going to talk about immigration in a little bit, but you know, we say blithely, people who overstay their welcome should be sent home. Think about where they're being sent. There is no work, and their current income is supporting I don't know how many family members in these small, poverty-stricken countries. I will say poverty is a little bit different thing. Nobody starves and nobody freezes. Doesn't make you with a lifestyle that we aspire to. So it's no longer a shared mission in the United Nations, and there is tremendous tension around the competing goals. Every session, the General Assembly opening session creates the forum for a variety of leaders to express themselves. Often they're attacking the United States. Then, elaborate developmental programs with ambitious goals and large financial requirements are passed, demanding that the developed countries pay for them. Well, the developed countries, not so many of them, vote no, but that doesn't matter. It's carried. So then, when the funding is not forthcoming, these countries accuse the more developed countries of breaking the promises. But those promises were really never made. And yet the needs are there. The bureaucratic mentality prevails. And protocol is almost worshipped. And so it's kind of almost like, it is the same in Iowa. If I don't get everything I asked for, it's a cut. Never mind, I got a little more than I got the year before. It still isn't what I asked for. Therefore, you have cut my budget. Still, the United Nations creates a necessary forum, and the original mission is badly needed still in the world. Okay, I'm going to move on now to the embassies. And so I hesitate to stop right now for questions. So if you have questions, will you save them till we get on just a little bit further? Okay, so what goes on at Embassy Bridgetown? It's a complex, diverse organization, a team of about 140 people, only 70 of them Americans. The rest, locally employed staff, have long tenure, almost all over 20 years of service, many of them since day one of the United States opening an embassy in Bridgetown. We are definitely the employer of choice abroad. We provide benefits. We target our salaries to the higher point of the local economy. So people want to work for us abroad. And that's a great thing. But the Americans usually serve a 3-year posting. This means 1/3 of the team turns over every year. So the real institutional history lies with the locally employed staff. So at least for me, I needed to rely on some of them to sort of make sure I wasn't committing cultural suicide. Not a good thing. Okay, and when I got there, it was like two teams. So you have the local team and the American team, and never the two shall meet. So even though we turn over 1/3 of the Americans every year, it's important for us to present one team. So who's the American team? Here we go. Foreign service officers. Political, economic, and labor. They represent the United States similar to the military, but they don't wear uniforms and they take their families with them. Really remarkable people serving their country. It's public service for them. I really learned to appreciate them. They live abroad. They move every 2 to 3 years to a different country. They educate their children on the local economy, and they make friends for America. Almost to a person, they are respected by their peers and their colleagues in their host governments. Political candidates in the media who like to talk about our so-called diplomatic failures, about how America's lost respect abroad, are naive, misinformed, or they seek to misinform. Those who describe how they will solve problems just by sitting down with anyone, anywhere, show a frightening lack of knowledge about how diplomacy works. Either that or they have an unusually high self-concept regarding their personal diplomatic skills. Providing a photo opportunity with the American ambassador and the ambassador from Cuba must not happen, because it goes back to the government-controlled media and can be described in any way they choose. And that's not a good thing for us. So I might say this is especially true for members of Congress. They're also the ones who make the funding decisions regarding foreign service people and programming. It's hard to accept their diplomatic efforts and sometimes as failures when every year I was in Barbados, we operated on a continuing resolution, which meant we were supposed to have the same amount of money we had the year before. But sometime in February or March, when their budget was reviewed, if we had overspent, of course we were told to cut back because there was no more money coming. But if we had underspent, if we were frugal and had decided we were going to save, they scooped that money and took it back. So the incentives, screwy as they are spend every nickel, or else they'll make you give it back. That's not a good thing. Remember Ginger Rogers, I liken that, you know, who said she does everything Fred Astaire does, backwards in high heels. I feel that way about embassies overseas. They're kind of the Ginger Rogers of the whole deal. So it's really important. One of the things that the ambassador must do is to develop some sort of a trust relationship with elected officials in your host countries. Of course, for me, that meant 7 sets of elected officials. It isn't that you want to be their best friend, but it is that you want to be trusted enough that when you need to have meetings, they are glad to meet with you. And usually that gets done by trying to help them solve as many problems as you can. The discussions are most fruitful when there are funds, services, or materials that leader needs or wants. World leaders often don't feel a moral obligation to tell all the truth. Certainly, they often do not represent their situations. A lot of sins of omission there. But we have to remember, desperate people do desperate things. Example, Dominica and St. Kitts, the Japanese invited them to be on the whaling commission because the Japanese really wanted to begin the taking of whales again. It had been outlawed in the past. They wanted, so they got 2 people, 2 countries, put on that commission who had agreed beforehand they would vote for the taking of whales. They failed to see the irony of the fact that whale watching was one of their big tourist attractions. But in truth, Dominica got a more or less paved road from the airport, and St. Kitts got a fishing harbor, which their fisher folk definitely needed, because they couldn't, at that point, even perform a search and rescue. You see the desperation that has to be there. So it makes you much more, forgiving of these issues where people do what they think they have to do. And who are experts? Both Chinese, the mainland, and the Taiwanese are experts at dollar diplomacy. Example, in Grenada, after the hurricane, we put up something like $43 million, and it got about the same coverage in the newspaper as the People's Republic of China ambassador who gave 100 soccer balls. That's how that works. And so you can't say it shouldn't work like that. Instead, you say, how am I going to manage it? Because that's how it works. And it's probably not going to change. But neither mainland China nor Hugo Chavez in Venezuela at the time had to worry about those pesky taxpayers. Okay, the next thing, the next service there is the consular service. And I want to say something that I think is meaningful to all of you, which is if you travel abroad, you should really go to the state.gov website and go to the country where you're going to be visiting and say, I'm going to be in country these days. Because if that's the case, if you, God forbid you should have illness or you should fall or you should get robbed or some other really terrible thing, when you call the embassy, the Marines will direct you to the officer of the day 24/7, and you'll get help immediately. That help is much faster coming if you've already told them that you'll be in country. So just a word, look, go to the website and say, I'm gonna be in your country on these days. And then you'll be hopefully you'll never need that. Now, one thing I wanna tell you is try not to go to jail. Try really hard not to go to jail because, the consular officers visit Americans in jail. They try to go at least four times a year, sometimes more if it's a difficult situation. And they take necessities, you know, like soap. But the thing we don't understand is neither windows nor plumbing are thought to be required. Enough said. Try not to go to jail. Okay. Our little consulate issued 46,000 visas every year. 46,000 in a less than a million district. A very big number. The consular general there said it used to be Yankee go home, and now it's Yankee go home, but take me with you. The appetite for visas is huge. America is seen as a land of opportunity. May not like everything about us, but they're very clear it's the land of opportunity. And that belief and that desire to come is more vibrant and dynamic often with people who are coming here than it is with those of us who just think that's how it's supposed to be. So, and regardless of what you see, hear, and read, we are still the most hospitable nation in the world, hands down. Work permits, education opportunities, a myriad of visa opportunities exist today. Let's not confuse people who need to come as refugees, many with serious problems, with those who want to immigrate to work, to go to school, to visit family, even just to shop. One time I was getting on a plane to come home and there was a woman beside me, a Bajan, that I knew. She had this gigantic suitcase. And so making conversation, I said, where are you going? She said, I'm going to the U.S. And then she opened her suitcase and there was another one inside and another one inside that and another one inside that. She was doing shopping for everybody. She had lists every which way. So she was headed to Miami and she was going to bring all four suitcases back full. So when we speak about immigration, we need to answer the question, what problem are we trying to solve? We say our immigration system is broken. That may be, but it's not nearly as broken as the system for accepting refugees. And yet we don't seem to be talking about solving that problem. Less developed countries, I told you, had two sources of revenue. So deportation is another issue that says send them home, especially those who have been arrested, convicted, served time in jail, and so forth. And they're not welcome in their home country. It's even too difficult to determine what the home country is sometimes because they own passports from multiple countries. This is especially true at Guantanamo. The people at Guantanamo sometimes have as many as 14 passports. So how are you going to pick one and determine that's where that person should be sent? Okay, I told you about All right, other departments at the embassy, drug enforcement, the IRS, that's about money laundering and banking, the USAID, which is trade assistance and capacity building, and reconstruction of services with our partners, the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. These people are saints and miracle workers. In about a 14-month period, we administered $43 million U.S. dollars, and we rebuilt Grenada after Hurricane Ivan. 1,000 homes, all the hospitals and clinics, the government buildings, and the schools. We follow the procedure of training people, providing tools and sometimes materials, and then overseeing their work as they rebuild their country. So we have built the capacity to be trained and have these skills and leave the equipment behind. That is the most compassionate and effective way to provide assistance. Now, politics definitely enter in. At one point when I was in Grenada reviewing what progress had been made and so forth, and I had two USAID people with me on the team, we were kind of summoned to the Prime Minister's office. And he wanted me to know that the way we were administering these funds was destabilizing his country. Translate that, his political opponents were also receiving assistance. So he, in order to avoid this destabilization, he thought he should be distributing the money. I said, you know, I fully understand that, but I really can't hear that word destabilize. That's just not something I can accept. So there has been a terrible tsunami in Asia, and this money is badly needed around the world. So if it's causing a problem for you, I'll just send it to Asia. And I could see his department heads over here going. And I could feel my USAID people think, can she do that? But anyway, it was clearly a misunderstanding and things proceeded as they were. On to the military liaison. They train the local police and military units. They provide, again, the tools, the vehicles for those units, and they teach the fact that their mission is to protect their country and not to overthrow it. These are key lessons. Key lessons. At one point, the Coast Guard is particularly valuable, as you might guess, and they are wonderful at training. I mean, it's really cool to see this happening. You'd be proud of us. But at one point on St. Lucia, I was handing over the keys to two what they call go-fast boats. They're like the little blow-up things, but they have a little cab on them that has two seats, and they're like tractor seats on springs, you know. And so I handed over the keys, and I got all the speeches about thank you and how wonderful and da-da-da-da-da. And so I'm saying, I gave you two boats, and I don't even get a ride? So, oh, the captain was so excited, so I got this huge orange life jacket on me, and I got strapped into this tractor seat beside the driver, and we're headed out, and it's funny, because on a much less desirable boat, the whole media for the island was complete with cameras. They're trying to shoot the ambassador riding in this go-fast boat. So I said to the guy, how fast is 40 knots anyway? He said, oh, that's why they call it a go-fast boat, Madam Ambassador. I said, okay, let's try it out. So it was so funny because we shot out of the water and left that media boat so far behind. Pretty soon we come spinning around and I'm going, hello, hello. I love stories like that. The FBI is there with legal attaches, and that's counterterrorism issues. They work with local governments so that, you know, the whatever you think of the Caribbean is a lovely place, and it is also a gateway for a lot of things to come to this country. It's our third border. So they partner with local governments and law enforcement to share information. They know who is coming and going, but more scary, who is coming and staying. And then there's the public diplomacy people. They're the ones that sponsor the arts and culture that we provide occasions and events for local people to attend. Artists, poets, authors, musicians, performers of all sorts are so effective. Finally, the Marine Security Guard. There's a battalion at every embassy in the world. And these are, for ours, we had 8 Marines and a gunnery sergeant. Their chore is to protect U.S. property and classified information. That's their job. They are just a classy group of young men and women, most of them taking work online. They're completing their education online. And bless their hearts, the Foreign Service people, most of whom have advanced degrees, help. A little bit tutor, it's great. So the first young woman that came, I interviewed all of them coming and going. And because I kind of laid out the expect. I've been told that Marines like to kind of have a really good time on their time off. And so I wanted them to be clear what my expectations were about their time off. And so I kind of laid out the fact that no matter whether they were in uniform or not, they were representing the United States and the President of the United States. I gave a great lecture. And the gunny once said to me, what do you say to them? I said, I kind of do this. And he said, well, thanks very much. You scare the bejesus out of them. But my first young woman, tiny, tiny Puerto Rican Latino, came from a family of 7. She was the youngest. All of her brothers and sisters were employed in the tourist business in hotels and restaurants. And she had looked around and decided she did not want to do that. So her parents allowed her to enlist right after high school. And so when I invited her in to interview, we had a great talk about all of that. And then I got a thank you note on just kind of a yellow pad written in pencil, thanking me for talking with her. And then she said, I never met a woman like you. How did you get that way? So we had lunch and we discussed how I got that way. And but she went on to Brussels at the International Court. She became fluent in many languages and is taking advantage of all the cultural opportunities in Europe right now, and I'm so, so proud of her. Okay, that's pretty much the embassy. Now, what does the ambassador do? It's not all cocktail parties, public events, and entertaining, although there's lots of it. And you know, Barbados was high enough, and most of the countries were, that during the day you had a nice breeze. About 5 o'clock, when it was time to get dressed up to go to something, the breeze stopped. So those of you who have read my first book about 14 times in there, I say, Did I mention it was hot? Oh, because it was. I kept my daily schedule on the classified email, so every day the agency heads would know where I was going and who I would be interacting with. And so we began to see, they came to me like things they needed to have, phone calls or meetings with people. They needed to give leaders a heads up about problems they need in their countries. Take an example in Dominica, which, you know, people say Columbus would still recognize it because it hasn't changed that much. But they had a bank, all right, 70,000 people. If anybody makes $20,000 US, it's a miracle. Maybe 10 people max. Anyway, they had $700 million in their bank. What's wrong with that picture? And so the IRS and the fraud and abuse people were in a snit. And this was a brand new, very young prime minister. And his people were not keeping him properly informed. So at the cocktail party, I said to him, sir, the Financial Action Task Force is going to close your bank if you don't make some changes and train people properly to run a bank. He was so shocked. He stayed over that night to meet with people the next day, the Brits, the Canadians, and the US. And they agreed that they would send trainers to fix it by Friday. On Thursday, there was less than $100,000 in that bank. St. Kitts was housing two U.S. drug kingpins. They were living very high. And you know, there's no campaign finance there. So I have no idea where the prime minister was getting his money or what he was doing with it. And so you could say it's none of my business, and that's true, except he wanted the Marines to build a police station for him in the north of his island. So I'm like, you know, as long as you house those two drug kingpins, I'm just not going to be able to work with you. I'm sorry, but I can't. I won't do it. And of course, my drug enforcement people were just cheering. And so he said, well, you know, your people are so rude and they're disruptive. And so I said, okay, so how would you like them to leave the island? And so he said, well, I want one of your planes to come to my airport after dark, and I want my security to deliver these two gentlemen to the plane. I said, okay, we can do that, hoping we could do that. But so the next day he called and said, I want the plane there tonight. And I said, sir, it takes 5 hours to get a plane from Puerto Rico. I don't think we can do it tonight. But I called the drug people back and they said, we could do it tomorrow night. And we did it. And he got his police station built by Marines on the north of his island, which was a win-win. You know, the drug trafficking was coming through there and they needed a law enforcement. So, my travel schedule. There's a little airline called Leeward Island Air Transport. Most people thought that meant leave island at any time. It was pretty good in the morning. You know, I get to the airport about 5 o'clock and it's that part's on time. The afternoon, serendipity. Yeah, but they all had VIP lounges. I gotta laugh at this because it's very serious business. The good news is they all had a restroom. And most of them had a sofa and two comfortable chairs. And it was a great place to meet people. But not when in the Dominica airport had no lights. So if you didn't get in there or out of there by 6 p.m., you weren't going anyplace. And so I always called dibs on the sofa in case I had to stay overnight there. But I swear, coming into, maybe you haven't flown in there, but you come in there, very steep, very mountainous country, and I swear you could pick a banana if you could put the window down. And here is the ocean, so let's pray the brakes are working. It's very exciting. Okay, my charge from the president was to maintain stable democracies, free and fair elections, respect for the rule of law, and my total focus is on activities that support that mission. The country team who consists of the leaders of every agency represented, met every Tuesday morning. In the first two meetings, we went around the table and everyone told me what wonderful things they had done that week. I thought, okay, this is a total waste of 3 hours. If I count up how much everybody earns and multiply that by the hour, we're investing. It's crazy. So I said, so hereafter, this is the mission. And you know what? None of them really realized that the embassy itself had a mission, which was maintain stable democracy. So in future, I'm interested in what you're doing, but you can just put that in bullet points and give it to my secretary. What I want from you is an agenda item that will involve all of us furthering the mission of the embassy. Wow. Then people sort of filed out. It was very quiet. The next week, almost nobody talked. So I try to convince them, I'm not trying to shut you up. I just need to know things that you're doing that I can help, they can help. So at some point, we got to that point, and I'm so proud of that team because they became a team, and they began to help each other, and we became way more effective. Last word, U.S. foreign policy. Although trade is important and necessary, the heart of our strategy has to be much more than trade. Our higher calling is the pact we make with our neighbors to work together to make things better among the poorest, most subjugated people in the world. When we do that, the world is better and safer for everybody, everybody. So we passionately promote democratic ideals in creating an environment where individuals are able to decide what is best for them. We promote free enterprise. It's the most perpetual and reliable engine for economic growth, centered on human rights, the rule of law, and self-determination. For me, that is the formula for achieving peace and freedom around the world. People who see themselves as entrepreneurs, who have some hope for their future, cannot be recruited to Al-Qaeda or to ISIS or as suicide bombers on the internet. It is hard and demanding work. I felt more pressure to succeed than anything I've done, but is it the right stuff? Absolutely. It was my job to make America more human, more value-driven in the eyes of the people of these small countries. One factor impacts everything, and I'm just going to pass over it, and that is United States media of all kinds is the source of news everywhere in the world. And so we see it's pretty awful, you know, parents murdering their children, school shootings, the murder rate in Chicago, teen gangs, serial rapists. There is no antidote. And so people think that's what America is. I invited the press to the residence at least once a month so that I could give them deep background. I didn't talk. I just said, what are your questions? And if it goes on the record, so be it. I don't care. We're going to talk things through. So one of the newspapers came out and said that the United States was going to repeal the Voter Rights Act, whatever they thought that was. And of course they were completely wrong. So I took our public relations officer and asked to talk to the editor and said, you are wrong. And you really, to be responsible, you have to correct this. So he sent probably his youngest, most inexperienced reporter to interview me. Poor thing, she was just shaking in front of me. But we got it fixed, and it is I wish I knew what to do about that. I'm sorry. Actually, when I got there, many people there said, I had never heard of Iowa. They said, is that in the U.S.? Yeah, it is. So why should we be concerned about any of this? Right here in the Midwest, safe and secure, why do I care? Why should you care? I have accepted all my life, taken for granted, the things my parents taught me. Things that were reinforced during the years that I was receiving a marvelous publication from kindergarten through graduate school, all in public institutions here in Iowa. My appreciation of the blessings I received and my appreciations of my life experience and my liberty grew exponentially through this experience. I'm ashamed of the complacency I took with me. I simply accepted. That's how it was. I forgot how it was earned it, who's still earning it today. As you might guess, I am more deeply committed to my country today than ever before in my life. It was a thrilling experience to be able to offer these small countries a positive vision of their desired future and to help provide them with the tools to get it. We've always been a revolutionary country, conceived by the founders to advance the cause of individual liberty. One of them said, I have sworn eternal vigilance upon the altar of God, eternal hostility against every form of tyranny. Nothing brings that home more forcefully than to be out of the country and have the contingent of Marines present the flag to me. I'll get them still talking about it. I watch them practice in the yard of the residence. They're out there in their shorts and their t-shirts and their bare feet practicing with the flags. And then, when it's the event, they're in their dress blues. They're carrying the flag, and it is perfect. Their pride and their precision is amazing. I look into those faces and know they have volunteered to lay down their lives for me. Teddy Roosevelt said, far and away the best prize life can offer is a chance to do work worth doing. Diplomacy is work worth doing, because when it fails, war often follows. It is a gift to be living here in this peaceful, prosperous city and state. I didn't comprehend that peace and security until I didn't have it for 4 years. I close with this quote, and then I hope we'll serve dessert and I will answer questions. Okay. I know I'm between you and dessert. Okay, here it is. Nothing we learn on the internet gives us deeper insights than the answers we found in the desert over 2,000 years ago. As Americans, we owe an extraordinary debt to the generations who brought us to the edge of a new and promised land. Their sacrifices not only brought us the good life, but through wars and hard times have kept our values alive, and these values are now the greatest gift we can pass on. I know this from personal experience. America is admired and respected, sometimes even loved abroad. But when we are, it's not because of our power, it's not because of our wealth, it's because of our liberty, of our freedom, of our values. So, it's your task and mine to demonstrate those values, to share them here in Iowa, across America, and wherever you go. You're great listeners. Hopefully, I have met at least two goals. You laughed, and I hope you learned something. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you. Okay, while dessert is being served, questions, let's have a talk.
You said you would, secure, communicate every day of what you were doing.
Yes.
Was there somebody in the State Department that reads that, or do they store it?
Well, both. Both. Part of the thing that took so long to get vetted is because I had the same classification as a four-star general, ambassadors do. And so there's appropriately a lot of vetting that goes on. Appropriately, it felt very intrusive, but hey, this is okay. And so yes, I was on the, I had the classified emails, and it was a new thing for me to put a schedule on there, but I wanted my team, who had access to the schedule, to know where I was going, because that way they could say, oh, she's going to meet with so-and-so, that's going to be at that party tonight. I want her to talk about this. So effective, so effective. But there was the open net and the classified information. I had two separate computers on my desk, and there were not very many people in the embassy who had access to the classified email system, communication system. And by the way, they still have cables. You know, this was, this early ambassadors carried the briefcase handcuffed to their wrist. You remember those stories? Yes. Well, do you think those times have passed? Anyway, they still send cables. The first two pages are who wrote it, who has read it, who has approved it, and who is able to read it. That's two pages of every cable. And often they are like, this is why this should be the most important thing the ambassador does today. Maybe yes, maybe no. Good.
So you go into this job, you went to like ambassador school, but when you are trying to make a decision or try to, so what I'm trying to figure out is like, we have Terry Branstad, who is in China.
Yes.
And we have a president who's doing things.
Yes.
And the Chinese don't probably like it.
Yes.
So how do you do that? How do you weigh what you're being told or what you're, and,
well,
how do you, and who do you check with when you're confused?
You have a whole team of very experienced people surrounding you. And so you're going to listen to everybody. But at the end of the day, that's the reason you're there. You often have to make a choice and a decision about it. Now, that decision might be, I'm going to talk to this person instead of that person and see what I can get done. But there is very clear guidance that comes back and forth through the cables on the classified information. So you have this background. Not only that, every morning you get a full picture of everything that's happened around the world. So you spend the first 40 minutes at least reading that. America is one of the few countries that allows for politically appointed ambassadors. I'm one, Terry Branstad is one. About 30% of ambassadors are appointed politically. The other 70 grow up through the State Department ranks. No matter what, the deputy chief is a very senior State Department official. So you have, and I had two fabulous women that supported me, just were great. So you get all kinds of guidance, and you have access. I mean, you can call the president if you want. You can call the Secretary of State if you want, which I did. I mean, a couple of times especially during the Grenada hurricane time, Colin Powell came in, and the Prime Minister was, this ain't it awful. And he said, maybe we should go back to raising cotton because we know how to do that. And Secretary Powell said to him, pull up your socks, man. You've already failed at that. I thought, well, if he can say pull up your socks, man, I guess I can. So, great questions. Other ones? Yes, please.
Your comment you just made about political appointments as opposed to tenured, let's say.
Yes.
What distinguishes those two? I'm sure they're by country,
yes.
But
that's a really good question. How do we decide if we're going to have a political ambassador or a career ambassador? Now, when I was in the ambassador, I'm going to give you a couple examples about the ambassador seminar. The ambassador who was then going to Afghanistan was a man whose family had immigrated here from Afghanistan when he was 14. He spoke all the languages. He was completely culture, whatever. And he was such a believer in America. It was just, you know, one of those, oh. Plus he was 6'8". But I think he took a unique perspective. He might not have known everything about the State Department, but he really knew about the job. He knew what needed to be done. The person who was going to Saudi had spent his whole career there as an oil executive. It was almost like Terry Branstad and the agricultural business. Hard to put it over on him when he's been in the thick of it for yay many years. So I think what happened with me is the ambassador before me was not very well behaved and was recalled. So when he said, we need some of that Iowa common sense down there, he was not kidding. So, but you know, nobody got around to telling me that till after I was there. Hello. So it was an interesting experience. But there's hardly anybody more than this. Often they call me the grandmother from Iowa. Because, you know, I learned what it was like. I was one of the very few white women, even fewer white gray-haired women on the island. And I was in the paper all the time, so you couldn't go anywhere without everybody kind of knew who I was. Yes?
Do you think Ambassador Branstad will have much effect as far as the trade as far as the crops and everything? The agriculture.
Oh, that's a good question. Will Terry Branstad, Ambassador Branstad, have an impact on the trade and the tariffs and what have you? Oh, yes, I think he will. Oh, yes, I think he will. He was very successful at facilitating trade. And those of us who are urban people, I saw this in the legislature when I was, you know, the soybean producers and the corn growers, and I respect those associations, but he listened and kind of responded. He kind of knows that business really well, and so yes, I think he will be very effective. And one of the things that served me the best was that I had been elected, because other people who were elected appreciated the fact that I knew that there were constituents, I knew there were all these pressures. You know, I knew sometimes you'd have to say something that maybe you didn't mean because your grassroots needed to hear it so you could get reelected, that kind of stuff, yeah. And goodness knows he's got that one down pat, so yes.
Mary, you were kind of a trailblazer running for office. Did you have politicians in your family, or how did you get involved
No.
in politics?
Oh, okay. How did I get involved in politics? Three women came to my door on a Saturday morning and said, we think you should run for office. And the answer is no, I have never, nobody in my background ever had anything to do with politics, no. And I thought I had a kind of a full-time job, you know. I was a senior officer at Wellmark Blue Cross and Blue Shield. I had responsibility for operations and human resources, and so I said, no, I'm not doing that. But Governor Ray was the boss. So they said, well, we're going to go see Governor Ray. I said, whoa, okay. So I said, if anybody goes to see the governor, maybe I should go too. And he so believed in the citizen legislature. He thinks the worst thing that happens is when it becomes a full-time legislature and people expect to be supported and expect to stay busy and create stuff that maybe they doesn't need to be created. And so we worked out an agreement, which I think was a great trailblazing agreement, which how I could keep my job at Wellmark and serve. And that worked fine as long as I was in the minority. But when I became the president of the Senate and I'm on the phone in the chair with the gavel trying to solve an employee relations issue, I realized this isn't going to work. So at that point, I went to John Forsythe and said, I can't do both of these things, so I'll retire. He said, I have a better idea. Why don't you run the foundation? So I left the operations side, and that's another story, but it's a great satisfaction. But Libby Jacobs, who ran for office, principals, Charles Snyder, who is the president of the Senate today, has the same arrangement with principals. So companies around the state looked at the example and figured out how to have that done. And so I feel I'm proud of that. I think we did the right thing there. So, yeah.
Does Barbados, the island, have consistent electric coverage and cable coverage, or is it a little bit that it's spotty and they have a hard time?
Yeah, Barbados is by far the most sophisticated island of all the ones that I had, 250,000 people. And I would say, electricity, no problem. Internet, not so much then. I think it's a lot better now. They had a monopoly called Cable and Wireless, which was a British company. And the Caribbean was sort of they were the stepchild of that company. And so there was not the real focus on that. But I honestly thought my husband was going to go back home and stay because it drove him crazy. He could not get on the internet. He could not get to his banking. He could not get to the, yes. So, and Kay is not happy. Mary's not very happy either. So we we had those stories. That's a great question because we are so accustomed to everybody being connected. When everybody isn't, it becomes a much more difficult thing to communicate, and it's much easier for the government to control what is done and what is said. So I think that's, there are definitely ups and downs to the freedom of the internet and Facebook and so forth, social media, but you can't put that genie back in the bottle. Yes, please.
Two questions. The first one is, which governor were you serving under when you were first elected to the Senate? In
Governor Branstad.
Branstad.
Yes.
And then the second question is, do you have concerns between how much the State Department has been cut by career diplomats? That seems to me that a lot of people that are attempting to take care of foreign policy at this point have no background on any culture or capability.
Yeah, that's a great question. So what's going on at the State Department? Is it diminished because there are so many positions not filled and so on? I am a little schizophrenic, so I'm going to give you both sides of my answer. The first is, when government programs are cut, the funding that goes into the programming goes away, but the people stay. So after a while, you get these layers of people whose program has gone away, and so it is in their best interest to maintain the status quo. And so, you know, kind of keep your head down and provide the paperwork as you're asked. And I don't mean that to be degrading. I mean, it's just, that's the way that works. And that isn't just at the federal level. It's, here we are. When the program gets cut, the people stay. Okay, so having said that, I am disturbed when I see what I perceive as disrespect for the cultural differences that exist. Because I think, like, you can totally disagree with me politically, and I think that's great. I'm not going to be offended. I'm not going to demonize you. I'm not going to dislike you. I'm not going to think you're immoral because you disagree. But that's a learned lesson. And I'm not sure, I fear we're going in a different direction as a nation. And therefore, people expect their elected people to behave in certain ways. And that's reflected throughout government agencies. My own experience is I had lived a long life and done a lot of different things. I could use every single thing that I've ever done was applicable in this job. And as I said, I felt more pressure to achieve than I had in anything else I've ever done. Well, maybe being a parent, you know, but you know what I mean. So I think it's a mixed bag, and I guess part of me thinks there really needed to be some disruption in how things are done. But I really don't think we need to stand outside and throw grenades. That's not the way to get that fixed. And we see quite a bit of that happening, not just at the administration level, but elsewhere.
Is there a difference between the job of the ambassador and the career diplomat?
Not when they sit in the ambassador chair, no. There isn't. When the ambassador is the chief of mission at the embassy, doesn't matter how you got in that chair, that's where you are. And the deputy is the deputy chief of mission at that embassy. And those two people really, it's like the CEO, the chief executive officer, and the chief operating officer in the business world.
And are there diplomats as well? I mean, terminology is what I'm
sure.
trying to figure
but
out.
I consider the Foreign Service people diplomats.
Right.
And they're well trained. I mean, you know, there's a university attached to the State Department. And when we need people with language, for instance, if you go to China and you're not the ambassador, you're going to spend 10 to 11 months in Chinese language classes. There might be four of you. You go 5 days a week with one teacher. Because we can't afford to have you missing innuendos and missing the details, and we just can't afford that. So you have to be purely cognizant of all of that. So, yeah, you all are good questioners. Yes.
Former ambassador club that you belong to, like retired
teachers. Yeah. Is there a retired ambassador? Well, there is. It's called the Council of American Ambassadors, but. And you become a member. This is my pin. I'm just really proud of that. My husband got it for me on retirement. But a woman named Ann Hand, whose husband was a retired ambassador, designs them, and you can't have it if you haven't served. So, you know, there aren't very many of those, and I love that. It meets in Washington, and often... It is not in the economic plan of Kay and Mary to spend that much money going to Washington, having beautiful dinners, listening to great speeches. No, and I made it a personal point now. If there's going to be more than three speeches, I don't go. Yes.
I just want to thank you for your service.
Oh, well, thank you.
In private and what you've done for the country. I don't know how much you're told that, but...
You're a dear. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was a nice thank you.
We want to let you eat your dessert, but...
Oh.
But I have one... Yeah. I want her to tell the story about Barbara Bush.
Oh.
That you told about the grandsons. Oh, they're getting...
Oh, yes. Oh! Hi, everybody. Yeah, I was... Oh, to you too. Yes, yes. Okay, I have been asked to tell one funny story. In the 2000 Republican convention in Philadelphia, I was invited to be the sergeant at arms of the family and friends suite in the arena. It was just a heck of a job, really. I had a great time. But when I first got there, some of the Bush family, then little boys, were You know, there was food, there were potato chips. It was cool, and they were just tearing around there. And they were beautifully dressed. They had their khakis and their deck shoes and their little navy blue blazers. They were so cute. But they were pretty much apart. You know, the tie was over here and the shirt tail was out. And Barbara Bush came into the room and she looked at those little boys and she went, and this is what happened. They start tucking in their stuff. Not a word. I think, wow, that's power. Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. Please talk to me. Yeah. I'm sorry, I missed, I didn't hear the in-between there. What's in the, give me the nutshell.
Molly Tibbetts?
The
one that got killed.
The what?
Molly Tibbetts. The one that got killed.
Oh. It can happen anywhere. They say women should not run and not do this and that, and I say, baloney. We ought to be able to do what we ought to do. However, it's like security for me. Let's not take unnecessary risks. Right now, I think it is the job of all of us to mourn Molly and to allow her family to grieve. If there comes a time when we need to do something different, politically or legally, then let's talk about that. But this is not that time. This is the time that we have to mourn. Yeah. Thank you for that. Sorry I missed you before. I didn't see you back there.
She's right behind you. I wonder why you're not running for national office.
Because I don't want the job.
You have a world with supporters here.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.